Hi, I'm Tom Biancooley, the Chief Technology Officer here at Zebra Technologies, and I'm joining you from our 3D printing lab where we make prototype parts, we iterate on our designs, and we've even made some of these entire products using 3D on-demand printing technologies. And the reason for this location will become much more apparent as I introduce our guest, Robert Wolcott, who's joining us for this podcast, where we're going to hear about the launch of his new book and the entire concept of proximity that's critical to your business, and as a preview, really, to what he and I are going to be talking about together at MODEX, which we're extremely excited about. So, Rob, I'll turn it over to you for introductions.
Great. Thanks so much, Tom. It's great to be with you, and having known you for a long time and followed the progress of Zebra and your work with companies around the world was part of the inspiration to what has become Proximity, which we'll get into later on. But for a way of quick introduction, I'm an innovation guy. I love the future. I love technology. I also like to explore the positives and the negatives, the pros and the cons, the effect on our daily lives, on society, et cetera. So I'm an adjunct professor of innovation at the Kellogg School of Management and an adjunct professor of innovation at the Booth School of Business. So that's University of Chicago and Northwestern. I guess it's sort of like teaching for Pepsi and Coke. But no, in the academic space, it's all one big happy family. So part-time, I'm an adjunct professor of innovation. And then I also have a group called the World Innovation Network, or TWIN. And you've been part of that, Tom. That's our logo back there. Essentially, we get together a few times a year, talk about the future, where things are going. And what's exciting to me about this group of innovation and growth leaders from around the world, like yourself, Tom, is that part of the reason I set it up is I wanted to, selfishly, I wanted to learn from all of you. I wanted to know what you were seeing, what your challenges were, what ideas you had for building the future. So that's TWIN, teaching, writing, convening, conversing, and I like to think listening from time to time.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rob, for the introduction. And I think the really value part of that whole TWIN network is getting the diversity of perspective. So, you know, from astronauts to artists, from entrepreneurs to Fortune 100 CEOs, you're getting this sort of, Renaissance coffee shop sort of, you know, discussion that you just don't have in a corporate setting. Yeah. And kind of frees up some of the thinking. So speaking of that, you know, the notion that the pandemic caused outward pressure to innovate, right? At an unprecedented scale. I mean, yeah. We saw what happened with e-commerce and the need to effectively shut down parts of the logistics chain, but yet still be able to deliver to people in an on-demand way. And that drove quite a bit of business for us during the pandemic, and the deployment of our technology to allow our transportation customers, our retailers, of course, in the healthcare space, to be able to react and respond. But the reality is that the need for, you know, innovation, constant innovation, has always been there. And the second we become complacent, we become vulnerable, because there's always someone out there that's rethinking how do they deliver the value that someone's providing in an entirely, you know, different way. And
absolutely.
So I'm mindful of the fact that you've spent 20 years making the case for continuous innovation. Why do you think business leaders need that constant reminder? Why do they need someone like you and some of the organizations that you're a part of to help build the business case for innovation when sometimes it's just so obvious to us?
It's a great question. We could talk for hours about it, but I think the punchline is established organizations get where they are by doing what they did before. And you became successful by being great at what you did before. And if we were in a steady state world where things don't change, then you could just keep doing that same thing forever. We all know and feel, and we feel it more today, that that is not the world we live in, and certainly not the world we're living into. And so the reality is, and we call this the success trap in the academic space, the reality is that the established enterprises are focused on becoming better and better at what they already do, and they have disincentives to look further out, to innovate, to invest in the future. Not just lack of incentives, actual disincentives, because those investments hit the bottom line today with no real guarantee that you're going to get a return in 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. And obviously, there are really good ways to solve this problem. We could talk a bit about that if you want. But the challenge is that while the established enterprises are focusing on what worked before, new entrants have to innovate to get into the game in a big way. Mm-hmm. So Tom, if some startup came to me, and I invest in a lot of startups, in fact, a lot of startups that are driving this proximity revolution we're going to talk about. And if a startup came to me and said, hey, Rob, we've got this great idea. We're going to build the same business as Zebra. And you know what? We're just going to copy their products and services, and we're going to go to market. What do you want to invest? And of course I don't want to invest in that, because no one's going to buy it from them. They already know Zebra. They trust Zebra. They're going to buy from you. Now, on the other hand, if a startup comes to me, or comes to you for that matter, and says, we can do this thing that you're doing now, we can do it 10x better and more reliably, are you interested in working with us? And the answer might be, yeah, let's buy an option on the future. Let's have a portfolio of options. And that's the essence of the solution, Tom.
Yep.
Any enterprise needs to have a portfolio of options on the future, because we cannot predict the future in detail, but we can see the contours of the future.
Yeah, that's great. Great perspective and you know, great reminders. I think, you know, at Zebra, we're always looking to balance that. You know, sometimes we refer to it as offense and defense, right? How do we protect the position we have, because we have this great number one market share, as you were alluding to, in so many core areas. But then, you know, where's the offense? And how do we need to be thinking about that and investing around that corner? And, you know, what I often say internally, where the offense meets the defense is the most simplest place to get alignment and consensus. Because if I think about the application of AI and machine learning, and I think about reading a barcode as an example, well, can we recognize products using computer vision? And does that disrupt the barcode, right? So it's both an offensive and it's a defensive move for us. And so we're investing in that in a whole bunch of ways organically. We also have a venture capital investment arm where we invest in startups that are in some of these places that we think that can be disruptive. So, you know, Rob, you were quoted as saying true breakthroughs won't happen due to being more efficient at what we already do. They'll happen by doing what was hitherto impossible.
Yeah.
Do you think that the reason innovation efforts, investments don't always have the desired impact is because people are innovating for the wrong reasons or with the wrong mindset? That they're trying to be more efficient without having to re-engineer anything. You know, essentially they're just trying to put a fresh coat of paint on the walls in the hopes that it'll brighten things up, when what they really need to do is knock the walls down completely and the whole infrastructure.
Yeah, so there are a whole range of questions you just posed, but I'll give one observation. So most companies that I talk to and work with, they notice this stuff happen. It's not like they show up at the office one day and say, oh my God, did you hear about AI? I didn't know, see that one coming. I mean, of course, it's been out there for a long time. It's happening fast now, but they see it happen. The issue is not that they don't see it. The issue is they don't appreciate the magnitude of the impact. So what we tend to do at an established enterprise, and this is true for government organizations and big nonprofits, we look at the new thing and we say, what could we use this for to be a little better at what we already do? And that's a good exercise, but that's not enough.
Right.
The question is, what does this thing allow us to do that we could never have done before? And when there are things that we could never have done before, the more different that new thing is than the past, the more dramatically it can enhance our ability to add value, create value, or even blow up entire industries. And so if companies stick with their current paradigm and they try and fit the new stuff within the paradigm, then they're seriously going to underperform in the long run. And as you said, offense, defense, it opens them up to a lot of risk.
Sure. Yeah. Makes sense. And it's a continuous conversation, you know, for sure.
Tom, let me digress, because I love this question, and I want to digress and give an example.
Sure. Yeah.
It has to do with how we see the world. And this is in my work, and others refer to it as well. I call these paradigms. We all have paradigms we use to understand the world. And by the way, we'll always have paradigms. That's the way we've evolved. If you don't have paradigms, it's hard to know what to do in the next second of your life, much less multiple years. So paradigms are there because they work until they don't. And then they become dangerous. So when there's a big step change in what's possible, the old paradigms have a tendency to mislead us. I'll give you a tangible example. The main reason most people don't buy electric vehicles, we know, is not cost. The cost is coming down fast. It's range anxiety. Now, it's an interesting observation, and there's research about this. most of the people who have this notion of range anxiety don't have electric vehicles. Why is that? Because when you have an electric vehicle, you realize you don't actually need charging stations all over the world. You don't need them all over the place. You don't need them like gas stations. Why is this? Well, because in many countries, like in the US, Europe, not all places, but in many places, people have homes. And in their homes, they often have garages. And Tom, I imagine like me, you can plug stuff in your garage. What you can't do is fill up your petrol-based car in your garage. So, and I've been saying this for a decade, a lot of these companies that are building out charging station infrastructure are going to lose all their money. And we're seeing it happen right now. Now, charging technology, that's different. You can make money on great charging technology. Cool. Tesla's supercharger network on key locations on long distance drives, that makes a lot of sense. But what doesn't make any sense is thinking that someone who drives 25 miles to work is going to worry about plugging their car in at the office because they need to fill up that last 25 miles. Right. We don't do that in our petrol-based. Right. So what people do, Tom, is they take the new thing and they cram it into the old paradigm. Yeah. And we do it over and over again. And that's what stands in the way.
Yeah, oh, that's a great example. And I think it's a great springboard into the whole concept of proximity, because the movement of, you know, what changed in what you described is going from central, you know, or more central stations at which the refueling, whether it's, you know, petrol or it's, you know, electricity in the latter case, has moved from kind of more of a distributed but still more centralized model to one where it's like literally in every,
yes,
you know, adjacent to every kitchen, you know, in
anywhere,
every garage.
Yeah.
And so the ubiquity fundamentally changes the model. Yeah. It is really cool stuff. So
by the way, Tom, and you, I know you're a technologist, and I'm going to guess that a bunch of other people listening with us are interested in technology. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of the history of technology. We talk a bit about it in the book Proximity. We open the chapter about electricity, how we power. Sure. We open it with a story about Nikola Tesla. And Nikola Tesla, who's predicted a whole lot of things that we have today that 100 years ahead of his time.
Yeah.
His vision in the long run was to have electricity available ubiquitously anywhere on the planet, mm-hmm, through version of inductive technology. Yeah. Now, his original vision is not bearing out exactly the way he had thought it would.
Yeah.
But we're seeing more and more indications that ultimately, and I believe in the longer run, Tesla will be right. And we'll have access to electrons to power things at any level, anywhere in the world, and eventually beyond the world.
Yeah, no, it's a very cool opening story there around Tesla. As luck would have it, you and I have spoken about where I'm standing on Long Island is only about 40 miles from the last lab of Nikola Tesla.
Introduced me to them. That's been really exciting.
It's a lot of fun, that project, to revitalize Tesla's last known lab at Wardenclyffe here on Long Island. And it is an amazing vision and an amazing number of inventions that really Tesla has put forward. And I guess really being the father of alternating current and being able to distribute power as we know it today to where and when it's needed in an on-demand way. And, you know, I don't know if he envisioned the exact idea of what he described, that I'd plug my car in the, you know, the garage, but he certainly envisioned the concept of being able to light up all of our homes and be able to do that, you know, across the entire country and distribute that value right to the edge where it can be consumed and used. Essentially,
exactly.
we take the word for granted when we call it a utility, but I mean, isn't everything to some extent, Rob, at, you know, technology wise, it's becoming more and more of a utility that we can access when we need it, where we need it, how we need it, in order to deliver on whatever value it might provide. I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, and then we'll jump into, you know, specifically the launch of your book.
Yeah, great, Tom. I mean, at the highest level, markets, business, et cetera, is about satisfying demands. And I'm going to oversimplify to make the point. But one thing we already know the demand side pretty well, and I mean this in a generic sort of meta level, but we know the demand side. The demand side is that human beings want whatever they want, wherever they want it, right now. And by the way, they want it for free, but let's set that aside. It's hard to deal with. So we already know that if whoever can figure out the value that an individual customer, organization, company, government, whatever value it is they're trying to achieve, whoever can provide that for them the most effective way, most efficient and effective way, is going to ultimately going to win. And so that's the demand side. The supply side, to me, is what's so exciting these days. The reason is there are more and more things we can do that we literally couldn't have done a decade ago.
Right.
So transition into proximity, where this effort came from that resulted in the book, about the same title, Proximity. Back in 2014, I remember I was at I don't remember what the event was, but it was a corporate event and people were talking about technology in the future. And I realized that everybody's talking about Internet of Things or artificial intelligence or whatever, pick your technology.
Yeah.
Additive manufacturing. I mean, I'm excited that you're in your 3D lab there at Zebra.
Yeah.
And we're all talking about these things, but I thought, you know, nobody's looking at the overall picture to try and understand if we can get some foresight into where the world's going. And the question we started to address was, are there some common underlying dynamics that digital technologies of all sorts, so include rooftop solar, 3D printing, they're all digitally enabled. Are there common dynamics that digital technologies drive that will give us foresight as to where the future is going?
Yeah.
And what we quickly realized was, the first part's not going to surprise any of your listeners, Tom, but it's the implication that very few people have noticed, and now we're seeing it happen in a big way. So the first part is, digital technologies of all sorts allow us to compress capabilities in smaller and smaller packages, all sorts of capabilities in smaller and smaller packages, and distribute them all over the economy, ever closer to each moment in time and space. So whether that's a 3D printing machine, or an app on your mobile device, or a QR code, whatever it is, it allows us to distribute these capabilities closer to each moment. And so therefore, and this is the punchline.
Yeah.
Therefore, digital technologies push the production and provision of value ever closer to the moment of actual demand in time and space. And that's the dynamic, that's the direction of every industry for the rest of our careers.
Right.
And what you talked about before, Tom, about the availability of electricity, that is a fundamental factor to enabling this drive of production and provision closer to the moment of demand. And just to put a fine point on it, when I first started talking about this, I think the first time I mentioned proximity was at an Economist Innovation Forum in Chicago. And I talked about proximity, and then it became clear to me that a lot of the people in the room are thinking, oh, he's talking about better supply chain management. And I sort of slapped my forehead and I thought, oh, okay, well, that's a nice thing. Uh-huh. But I'm not talking about that.
Right.
I'm literally talking about setting up business models and technology platforms to encourage us to procrastinate, to wait as long as possible before adding any value at all.
Right.
Now, that's the ideal case. But imagine if you could wait until there's a specific customer ready to pay for a specific product, service, or experience, and then you create it and provide it coterminous, co-located. That's the direction that we're all going. At different paces, it's going to take different amounts of time in different industries. There are going to be some products that take decades before we get close to that. And others, it's been happening for a long time, like video streaming. Totally digitized. You can watch anything you want, anywhere you want to watch it now. That's one of the early examples of proximity.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's great, Rob. And I think the reason we've adopted at Zebra the whole proximity concept, and we use it frequently in our customer engagements at some of the highest levels, is because the trap, if you will, of what you described earlier, that so many times the conversation starts off with, well, an IoT or an automation conversation, or how am I going to use this technology or that wireless technology? And fundamentally, when you get down to, hey, what are each of those technologies in service of? Like, what are they really trying to promote? Yeah. It's the business challenge of being able to push that value ever closer to the point of demand. And that starts to unlock, A, it unlocks people's thinking, and B, it gets to value much faster, because rather than falling into the trap of, we'll create an IoT platform or we'll create sensors, it's literally saying, hey, can I dynamically set the price of a perishable piece of produce like blueberries, because I can literally see the moment from the moment they were harvested all the way to the point that they got to the shelf at the retail location, what exact temperature, environmental conditions, humidity were they exposed through that entire journey?
Yeah.
I can set on-demand pricing ahead of those blueberries perishing, right? So rather than saying they're starting to go bad, now I'm going to cliff the price down because I'm just going to try to move them out. We can very easily predict, or very accurately predict, exactly what the cycle is going to look like of perishability, and then start to set the gross margin profile of the pricing in a way that's staged to optimize profit, minimize waste, do better by the planet,
and,
you know, deliver a better product to the customer. Yeah. And all of that's only possible if you think about, in this case, the pricing being delivered in a dynamic on-demand way and the product being visible as it's moving through that entire supply chain. And, you know, these are the sorts of things that they're just game changers in terms of even business models with our customers. But you got to get people kind of thinking at that level and get out of the sea and the swarm of the headlines of all the technology du jour.
Well, and also to build on that, Tom, when in the book Proximity, my co-author is Kaihan Krippendorf, and he and I have identified five components of proximity strategy. And one of those components speaks to your specific point, which is if you're trying to be the most competitive on the planet in producing and providing what your customers want, where and when they want it, you need a lot more. It's sort of ironic, really. You want to be better at that moment of demand. You need a lot wider and better visibility to everything that goes from pulling stuff out of the ground to providing that product, service, or experience.
Right.
So you need better visibility across the whole ecosystem of players. Sure. And the more you have that, the more you can see big opportunities to transform the model, not just the small incremental stuff. I'll give you a tangible example.
Sure.
We talk a lot about in the book, Dr. Jeffrey Ling is a personal hero of mine. I think you've probably met Jeff, Dr. Ling at a twin event at some point, but he was with the military.
Dr. Ling was a person that said, and I'd invite people to go check it out at your twin conference when
he
presented. And the hook for people to go watch it was, he said, with an egg and a pencil, you can make any medication on the planet.
You give me a pencil and an egg and I can make anything you want. Yeah. So he was a military doctor with the Army, retired as a colonel. He had 6 tours of duty in the Middle East. In these environments, they kept running out of critical generic drugs. Now, that's not shocking in a war zone. But what was shocking to me, Tom, and I know you have clients in healthcare. Yeah. I didn't know this. We have generic drug shortages all over the United States every day. Dr. Ling practices at Johns Hopkins, now one of the top institutions in the world, and they have generic drug shortages. So what everybody else was doing was trying to figure out the supply chain and improve inventory management and make sure that you have better demand planning and all this. And Dr. Ling said, wait a minute, most generic drugs are synthetic chemistry drugs. They're made of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen.
Yep.
So presumably, if I had the right piece of equipment, I could make anything I wanted right here from generic ingredients.
Right.
Now, at the time, people thought it was nuts. Is that that's not going to work. Here are all the reasons it's not going to work.
Right.
But Dr. Ling went to DARPA, where, you know, our military thankfully invests in crazy ideas, and some of them work out, like the internet. Yep. And he got a big grant from DARPA. He worked with a team from MIT, and they created a piece of equipment that today is proven it works. The FDA has confirmed that the drugs that come out of this equipment are exactly the same as you'd get at the pharmacy. And it allows you to sit around and wait until you know, hey, Tom, we need 1,000 doses of atropine.
Right.
You type in 1,000 doses of atropine, and hours later come out 1,000 doses of atropine. Yeah. We need 300 pills of ciprofloxacin. Hours later, out comes 300 pills of ciprofloxacin. If any of your listeners are interested, you can look it up. It's called On Demand Pharmaceuticals. I did not invest in it for various reasons, but I'm a huge fan. I follow it very closely. And they have their first commercial implementation already in the field in Tupelo, Mississippi, making injectables. So they're starting slowly to prove it in a real clinical setting. And it's working great.
Yeah.
They chose Tupelo because Tupelo kept experiencing these critical shortages. It's a very poor part of the country. They have needs that aren't being met. Now they've got this equipment here at this health center, where they make exactly what they need, where and when they need it, from raw materials. So they're not producing them in a factory in China or India months before, putting them in a warehouse, throwing them out every 2 years because they have a shelf life.
Right.
They're waiting around until there's a specific patient that needs that thing, and they're making it right there. And yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And Dr. Ling is an amazing presenter as well. So yes, I would encourage people to go check that out on the Twin channel on YouTube. He presented a few years back. So yeah, you mentioned already, Rob, you know, that obviously you've co-authored the new book called Proximity. It launches in May. Yep. You and I will be together, as I mentioned in the opening, at Modex in the middle of March, which lot of people watching this, hopefully you'll be able to join us there. We've committed working with you at Zebra to have about 150 books that we'll be sharing with the public after it launches in May. So people won't get it right there at Modex, but we'll be taking, you know, names and collecting information to be able to share those. I'm really excited by the opportunity that creates to have more of a community around talking about the implications of proximity and really putting it into perspective relative to digital technologies that allow us to push that production and provision of value, those products and services and experiences nearly to the moment of demand. And it's not just, like you said, forecasted demand, but as you like to say, real ready to pay for it demand. And so, you know, as we look at that, we look at the dynamics happening in the marketplace. And I mentioned the venture capital investment arm we have. We invested in a company called Forkites.
Right.
And Forkites they're doing some, you know, you've had the chance to kind of check them out. They're doing some really exciting stuff where they're managing and monitoring goods and products as they move through the supply chain in real time. So they're doing that by aggregating telemetry information from various different sources, some that are provided by third parties to carriers, others that were built by those carriers themselves. And they're able to basically forecast estimated time of arrivals with very, very high degrees of precision. And one of the things that I've noticed is with the concept of proximity, as that is the procrastination, as you've put it, is driven, whether it's B2B or B2C, driven the decision to order to kind of the last moment.
Yeah.
I'm hopping around a bit, but we did see in a B2B context, one of the largest medical distributors in the United States say to us that even hospitals now are ordering in a more of an each based way, as opposed to bulk ordering. So we're all used to doing that from an e-commerce perspective.
Yeah.
You know, order something at 3 o'clock and I order something different at 5 o'clock, you know, from Amazon. But to see a hospital doing that, I think is pretty profound. So anyway, as that procrastination to the moment of need happens from an ordering perspective, we're seeing our customers say, hey, for me to react to that, I can't operate the way I was operating. I have to operate in a way that shows me exactly where all my capital assets are, my vehicles, my trucks, what the weather equation is playing, where the goods are on those vehicles, and even become predictive about where things are going to become. So I anticipate somebody ordering something and I can intersect my supply chain with that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a fundamentally different way of operating.
Yeah.
And it requires all kinds of, you know, visibility and analytics and prediction. So yeah, I'd love for you to kind of comment on how you're seeing that impact the supply chain use cases around that.
Well, by the way, Tom, you pointed out Forkites to me. I was excited about, because I love to see actual examples of these things in the real world. And that's exactly the sort of capability that's going to be needed to make good on this proximity promise. But I'll take it a different direction. And we could talk about this for hours, but I'll take it a slightly different direction. An opportunity for all of your clients, and frankly, for Zebra as well, for all of your clients, is to look across all the products they offer consumers, if they're retail or if they're a manufacturing company or if they're, you know, in the middle of a supply chain, value chain, for instance. Look at those products, ingredients, whatever it happens to be, that are the most strategic and important for you. Then figure out which ones have the most supply chain risk currently. And if you run out of it, if you can't get to it, it costs enormous. It's not just the per unit. It has enormous knock-on effects, right? When you do that math, you start to identify some things where, you know what, it might not make sense today on a unit basis,
right,
if everything's working great in the world, to invest in 3D printing, for instance, to do this. But you know what? If we do the math on the risk, we realize if there's a tsunami in Thailand and it knocks out a couple of manufacturing facilities, which happened in the past, right?
Yeah.
Now it starts to make sense for us to, for specific strategic ingredients, components, products, et cetera, to invest in on-demand capabilities in our infrastructure. Now, let me give you an example. It's one of my favorite examples. I did invest in this company, and so far, so great. So in 2018, a good friend of mine, she's a French plant scientist. She was a venture capitalist for a while, but she was always pulled back to plants because that's her thing. And she called me in 2018 and said, "Rob, I would like to figure out how to grow food on Mars." I said, "What?" It sounded like you said grow food on Mars. She said, "Yes, this is what I said." I said, "Well, okay." And she said, "Would you like to invest in my company?" And I said, "No, of course not. I'm not a billionaire. I can't wait 50 years for a payback." And she laughed because she knew that I wasn't the right target for that. But she got a grant from NASA. She got a grant from the ESA. And that project for figuring out how to grow food on Mars or the moon or in spaceships, that continues today. And they've made a ton of progress. But Barbara, her name's Barbara Belbisi. Barbara also knew she needed to build an actual business for the sort of near to medium term. So what she did was exactly what I explained to you. She looked down the list of ingredients that are derived from plants that are very high value, very low volume. Mm. And interestingly, coincidentally, Barbara lives in Paris. So what industries need plant-based ingredients at very high value, low volume? Well, cosmetics, fragrances, skincare, all these industries where France is a world leader. So she looked at these plants and she and her team created a biopod. The pod is about the size of probably the room you're in right now. You can walk into it. I've been in one outside Paris. And they grow in optimized environments. Any plant that you decide is of value, they can grow in optimized environment. I'll give you one example. A plant called vertivé. There's an ingredient derived from the roots of vertivé. It's a very high value ingredient. It grows in Indonesia and India. And so supply chain's an issue. So in this pod, she can grow, they're already growing vertivé, and the yield is 1,000% better than in the wild.
Amazing. Yeah.
Now here's the punchline. Her biggest clients are Robotech, the biggest ingredients company in the world. And now, they just announced it a few months ago, L'Oreal. So L'Oreal is buying these pods, they're installing these pods in their manufacturing facilities.
Yeah.
And so now L'Oreal will be able to make exactly the amount of vertivé they need in exactly the right location, and they are completely free of any supply chain risk.
Right.
And the punchline for Barbara's company is she doesn't sell them the pods. She sets up the pods and they remotely monitor them and optimize them and build a database of understanding how to dramatically increase the yields of these various plant products. So she calls it hardware on demand. Mm. And so what does this mean? And any of your clients can do this. Any of your clients can say, what are the ingredients, the components, the products where we need to invest in on demand because it'll protect us.
Right.
Make us more responsive, decrease our reliance on great demand planning for next year and that sort of thing. So this is where the world's going.
Yeah, no, I love that example because it's a bit of a blueprint of saying, how can I tackle challenges where maybe a company's experiencing today from a supply chain resiliency perspective?
Right.
While also building in the strategic advantage of being able to deliver and it's a guaranteed outcome. That people are going to want things faster, quicker, and at lower cost. Like this is never going to change. It's not like we're going to wake up one day and people want things slower for more money.
Right. Yeah.
And they want less selection. They're going to want more selection delivered faster at lower cost. And so if you can sort of solve your supply chain resiliency problem through the kinds of thinking that you just described with the biopod, but you're also then setting up the bank shot to be, you know, more competitive from a on-demand perspective, it's kind of a win-win. So
amazing.
Yeah, that's a great one. Really cool. You know, I guess without giving away too much of what's in the book, let's talk a little bit more about the importance of proximity in today's on-demand economy, as well as from a forward-looking perspective. So, you know, there's definitely long-term implications here, especially when it comes to competitive differentiation. There's an urgent, immediate need for companies to be aware of current demand and respond accordingly. This is where I think many companies seem to struggle, right? They sometimes can't see what's happening, you know, sort of right in front of them and respond in a way that's going to drive the change required, both from a mindset perspective, a functional perspective. It may seem unmanageable for a lot of companies, but you share stories in your book of companies that are using proximity to better serve their customers, companies that appreciate the risks of not embracing proximity. So why is this something, you know, other than just, you know, the examples that we're both talking about here, which it's great to talk about real world examples, but why is this something that people should take seriously and embrace right now as a survival strategy? And right. if you could, Rob, maybe talk a little bit about it in terms of horizon. Like, you know, is it a survival strategy for the next, you know, that's going to impact me in the next 3 years? Is it a 5-year arc? How do I need to think about this if I'm a business leader dealing with the kinds of challenges we're talking about?
Great. So great leaders are defined by changing before a crisis. And I mean, I can think of a few companies that have done, like Walmart has changed their strategy, fundamental aspects of their strategy, multiple times in their history before a crisis. And that's a mark of great leadership. So when you talk about horizons, Tom, that's the right way to think about it. Mm. There are clearly going to be very different things I need to do this year compared to 3 years, compared to 7 years. But the further out I go, the more I need foresight to be better at making my decisions today. And so thinking about how when you have a paradigm like proximity and you understand how profoundly that's going to change the world, you can look at each individual industry or consumer need in their lives and ask, if this is totally proximate 20 years from now, how might the world look? And when you do that exercise, you can work backwards and realize the implication for your own company, your own industry. So I'll give you an example. In our book, we organize by industry. So how we work, how we eat, how we prevent and cure, how we create and produce, which includes distribution, how we power electricity, and how we defend. Mm. And in the last chapter, we talk about virtual reality and space, which we could talk more about. That's cool stuff. But in each of the industries, we pull out punchlines from within the chapter as to how proximity looks different in each of these industries, how it will shift the foci, the competitive dynamics in each industry. So the most tangible example for all of us is in the healthcare chapter, which is how we prevent and cure. Mm. Kaihan and I assert that proximity pushes healthcare from curing things to preventing things. Mm-hmm. Why is this? Actually, very easy to understand. So my father died in 2004 at the age of 63. He had an aortal aneurysm. He had just had a complete physical, clean bill of health. And 2 months later, he dies. Now, fast forward to the not distant future. We already have Apple Watches, and that's nice, Aura rings. But imagine in 10 years when we have always on all body monitoring. And you've got a very simple set of technologies. They're monitoring your heart rate. They're monitoring maybe your arteries in some way. There's a new imaging, blah, blah, blah. So they're monitoring every aspect of your lift system. And that system says, hey, Tom, you know what? We've noticed you have some signs that suggest you might have stage 0 pancreatic cancer. Don't worry about it. Go to the doctor. We can fix that. It's not a big deal. Compare that to today. If I have, you know, I have symptoms and boy, oh boy, I'm not feeling well, I go to the doctor and they say, sure. Boy, Rob, you know, we have bad news. You've got stage 4 pancreatic cancer. There's not much we can do for you. And so this is what we mean by proximity pushes healthcare from curing things to preventing things. It completely changes the dynamics. And here's the exciting part, Tom. We know this is coming.
Yes.
This isn't, oh my gosh, is this going to happen? No. This is coming. Yep. So now you as a business leader, as an investor, can see that future world in a new light and make better business and investment decisions.
Yep. Yeah, you know, love the example in healthcare. And, you know, it really reminds me of some work we've done with Professor Martin Curley out of Maynooth University. And we had the opportunity to present with him at the UN General Assembly Council last year, actually, in the Digital Health Symposium. And what I love about Martin is, he's just got very, you know, right to the point, you know, ways of conveying where things are going in healthcare. And Rob, he would be a big fan of proximity. As he talks about, the future of healthcare is not illness being at the center. If you think about your point of, you know, hey, you're ill and then we're going to make you better. So yeah, illness is at the center, and then it's moving from illness to becoming healthy. It's that wellness is at the center of healthcare. Yeah. And the whole thing becomes about prevention using the types of instrumentation you were talking about, and becoming, you know, just like we spoke about the supply chain, becoming predictive.
Yes.
About, you know, where that demand is going to be. It's becoming predictive about what's going to happen in, you know, in my body, and being able to react to that.
Amazing.
Before it becomes an issue. And
by the way, I'd love to connect with him. He sounds fascinating. But you think about the implications of this.
Yes.
Talk about an impact on costs.
Yeah.
Talk about an impact on quality of life.
Sure.
I mean, wouldn't anyone rather solve the problem before it's even a problem?
Absolutely.
As opposed to what we do today, which is waiting around until it's maybe too late.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is another proximity to the edge kind of concept is.
Yes.
Martin will also say that healthcare is going to move from doctor knows best to patient knows best. And it's really right at the heart of what you said, because the patient knows best, meaning we're carrying around the data.
Yeah. Right.
Who else is carrying around the data about the way our bodies are operating?
Yeah.
Through through this idea of physical instrumentation, and so being able to use that in a way that prevents is just amazing. So, hey Rob, I got, before we wrap up here, I want to ask you just one other question. You speak with folks in academia, you speak with business leaders. You're in researching and writing the book you're about to launch in the next couple of months. What is the biggest takeaway, the biggest lesson? And I know it may be impossible to distill it down to one, right? But if you were to give our viewers, you know, what's something, a nugget to walk away with that, you know, you learned going through those dialogues and those discussions, how might you, you know, summarize that for our viewers and, you know, just give them a takeaway to think about?
I would say, Tom, make sure you're solving the right problems. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to have confidence that you're solving the right problems, that you're posing the right challenges to yourself and to your team, unless you have some level of foresight,
right?
Some high quality foresight. I'll give a quick example to conclude. Before COVID, I was speaking to the leadership team of one of the big bond rating agencies, and there are only three, so take your pick. But and they had this objective. They had a small team together with a small budget, with a specific objective. I love this model for innovating, by the way. Mm. But the objective of the team concerned me a bit. They said they wanted to take their offering response time for a critical offering from the company from 2 months down to 2 weeks.
Wow.
And I said, boy, oh boy, that's bold. Congratulations, very, very impressive. It's gonna take a lot of work, but here's the problem. What happens if you and your team go through all that effort and you win and you figure it out, and a year later, you've got that response time from 2 months to 2 weeks? Then what happens if a couple of years later, somebody else launches the same thing in 2 minutes?
Right.
Now you have wasted all that time and effort, all those resources to go from 2 months to 2 weeks, and it's irrelevant. And they all deflated and they realized what I meant. They're in bond rating. You know what they do? They told me, they said, Professor, we take data and we analyze it. That's all. We don't really do any. I mean, we take customers to dinner, but that's all we do, right? So the reality was clear. There's no scenario where sometime in the next 3, 5, 7 years, I don't know, somebody's going to be able to do exactly the same thing in a matter of minutes because of AI, data analytics. So it was already clear.
Right.
You could already see that. You had that foresight. But they had created the wrong challenge. And so I'd say the one thing that I would hope people would take away, Tom, is think hard about this proximity thing and where it's going to add value for your customers and your customers' customers in the future, because we know this is where it's going. And then with that light, make sure you're asking the right questions and posing the right challenges.
Yeah, that's a great bit of feedback. I think this idea of really thinking about the art of what's possible, you know, what's valuable. And the art of what's possible is changing faster than ever, right, Rob? I mean, you talk about this all the time, yeah. you know, due to technology. And then looking at what's valuable and really framing that in a way that's going to where the puck is going to be, you know, as opposed to solving the problem with the constraints. So it's kind of getting to first principles thinking is a lot of, I think, what you're saying. And you know, what from first principles thinking can we build because it's possible today that wasn't possible before? Yeah. And how does that disrupt this? And I love the, you know, the bond rating example, because you don't think those kinds of use cases, right? When you think about the kinds of innovation we're talking about. So now, awesome.
By the way, Tom, a quick note, an encouragement to everybody listening. If you're at MODEX in March, I think I'm speaking on March 12th. You and I are going to be on the stage together.
Yep.
In addition to, it'd be great for you to be there and to hear our session. But even more than that, as Tom knows, I love hearing what other people think, what they're seeing in their industries, in their context. And the part of the reason I reached out to you, Tom, you were one of the first people I reached out to when we were planning for this launch, is that you're in the middle of these transformations all the time. So I want to know what you're seeing. Sure. And so I'd provide the invitation to everybody at MODEX to come by our session. I want to hear what you're seeing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, you know, another piece of advice you may not mention because it's so obvious to you, Rob, and the way you operate is being a good listener, right? And just really understanding.
Sorry, what?
A good listener.
No, I'm kidding. It was a joke.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. And it was a really bad joke.
I know. And I fell right into the pothole. I mean, you know, I scraped my knee on that one. But yeah, no, really, it is that listening. And we talk about that all the time. And as a culture, is a customer first culture that's really starting with, hey, what kinds of problems are our customers trying to solve? And working backwards, as opposed to, hey, we have a pile of things, you know, we can come in and deploy inside your environment. And I think there's a level of leadership to that you mentioned, you touched on. There's a level of vulnerability. Hey, we don't know what we don't know, but
Humility too, Tom.
Exactly, humility. If we could all admit what we don't know, we could probably navigate to the correct answer much more effectively. Yeah. So I too would invite everybody. March 12th, you and I will be presenting, and that presenting part will be great. But more important than that will be, you know, networking, connecting, sharing ideas. And we promise, if you're at the session with us, we'll do an equal amount of listening as we do presenting and chatting with you all. So I'm really looking forward to it. Rob, great to talk with you and look forward to seeing you in Atlanta in March.
You too, Tom. Thanks so much. And thanks to the Zebra team for helping set this up.
Thank you.